this meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order. I'll let the record show that it's January the 27th, and it's 1 o'clock. On today's agenda, we have the Department of Public Safety Division Overviews, and there are four of them. And at this point, we will call on Mary Ellison, the Acting Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison, and I'm Acting Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. As many of you have no doubt heard, the governor has named Mona Doman. She's currently Chief of Police in Maple Grove as the new commissioner in the Department of Public Safety. She sends her greetings. She's not able to start until the beginning of March, and so you will be able to meet her at that point, and I know you'll enjoy working with her. Today what we're going to do is, for the Department of Public Safety, we're divided for purposes of legislative oversight into two divisions. One's the Transportation Division and one's the Public Safety Division. So the Transportation Division in the Senate and the House oversee our Driver and Vehicle Services, Administrative Services, Office of Traffic Safety, the State Patrol, and the Office of Pipeline Safety. So what I'm going to do today, I have all of the division directors of those various divisions behind me, and I'm going to go through some slides and go over some overview, and then when I complete the slides for each division, I'll ask the division director to come up in case you have any questions. Oops. The mission of the Department of Public Safety is to protect citizens and communities, prevent, prepare, respond, recover, educate, and enforce. Focus on saving lives, providing efficient and effective services, and maintaining the public trust and developing strong partnerships. As I mentioned, the transportation divisions include the Minnesota State Patrol, Driver and Vehicle Services, the Office of Traffic Safety, Administration and Related Services, and the Office of Pipeline Safety. Our 2012 and 2013 biennial base budget includes the following funds. The total is $306,632,000 for the biennium. 7% or $20,812,000 of that is from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. 56% or $171,736,000 is from the Trunk Highway Fund. 5% or $15,908,000 is from the general fund, and then miscellaneous special revenue makes up the rest of the budget with 32% at $98,176,000. Our expenses for the 2012-2013 biennial budget include the following. Payments to individuals, that's basically we provide funding for bulletproof vests for law enforcement officers, and also we administer a program that provides assistance to the cities who are providing continuing health care insurance to police officers and firefighters who are injured in the line of duty. We transfer $4,236,000 or 1% of the budget to other state agencies and other funds. Our operating expenses, which is everything, special equipment, rent, supplies, everything other than compensation, is 25% of our budget or $76,088,000. Our total compensation is $222,510,000 or 73% of the budget.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, can you, when you bring up, equipment, vest, and that, have we in the legislature created any laws or statutes that create undue competition for equipment that you need? I guess what I'm saying, do we have statutes out there that don't let you purchase the best quality equipment or make you purchase from one area or another? Am I making sense here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, I think I understand your question. The department or the state of Minnesota has procurement laws and rules there that are administered by the Department of Administration and the Minnesota Management and Budget Agency. Those requirements call for us to put out requests for proposal to purchase equipment and to purchase other services. And so that does allow for competition and for people to bid. As far as I know, it doesn't prevent us from purchasing what we would like to purchase.
Okay.
Thank you. Sorry about that, Senator Perry. I was a bit distracted by talking to staff here, but appreciate the question. You would like to proceed?
The first area is administration and related services. That includes our Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, our Human Resources Division, Fiscal and Administrative Services, the Office of Technology and Support Services. Next is the Minnesota State Patrol. Their mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. The Minnesota State Patrol has an annual operating budget of $83,119,000 and a staff of 875 full-time sworn and non-sworn personnel. For the 12-13 biennium, $158,378,000 is from the Trunk Highway Fund, $1,570,000 from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, $6,290,000 from the General Fund, and approximately $19 million in federal funds.
Excuse me, Senator DeCreef.
Thank you, Chairman. I have a question about the Highway Patrol. The what duties do the Highway Patrol specifically perform out in the greater Minnesota area that the local county sheriff's department do not?
I'm going to ask Colonel Donaski, the colonel of the State Patrol, to give you a description of that.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mark Donaski, D-U-N-A-S-K-I, Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol. I'm sorry, sir, your question again, please?
What specific services does the State Highway Patrol perform in greater Minnesota that the local county sheriff's departments do not?
The Minnesota State Patrol is specifically tasked with providing traffic safety functions on interstate and Minnesota trunk highways.
That's the biggest, that's the difference.
That's the biggest share, yes, sir.
Okay.
The Minnesota State Patrol services included.
Excuse me, Senator Perry.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief, let me ask you another question. Of course, some might not know I spent my time in law enforcement. I guess as we take a look at the State Patrol, and I don't get me wrong, I love everything, the expertise. And this is just a question. I see the amount of roadways that need to be patrolled and efforts done, say, in the 7-county metro. Would our citizens be better served to use the State Patrol for their expertise at the time of need in greater Minnesota? And I bring this up because I know you folks have fabulous accident investigation teams, far superior, I believe, than ever I remember as being on the sheriff's department or the police department, though we tried, but because we handled so many different items. Would it not be a better service to the citizens to concentrate the patrol more in the heavier areas that we see in the metro area and call upon them in greater Minnesota at the point of need, because you got helicopters, you got planes. I mean, you could get there pretty much as fast as you need. I'm looking for more efficiencies maybe to control and better use the service. And maybe, for that matter, even look at we're talking about the safety of this great building that we're in right now, to be able to use the expertise of peace officers in those areas.
Colonel Donaski.
Mr. Chair, Senator, very good questions. There's actually a number of them in there, and I certainly would love to have the conversation, and hopefully sometime we can come back and have an elongated conversation about the role of policing as public safety and how it's divided amongst local, county, and state agencies across the country and their roles. As far as concentrating resources, one of the challenges, of course, is that if you take the Minnesota State Patrol off, let's say in the metropolitan area, off of the highways, somebody does have to fulfill that obligation. And you could certainly turn around and say, well, let's have the sheriff's office do it, or let's have the local agency do it. I suspect that if you talk to the Hennepin County Sheriff or the Ramsey County Sheriff or the Minneapolis Police Chief, they're going to tell you that they don't want to have anything to do with it. And I'm not speaking for them, but there's a lot of effort that goes into it and a lot of process. In addition to that, keep in mind that we use trunk highway funding for that. So now what you'd have to do is you'd have to have a transfer of trunk highway funds to other agencies in order to do that. And now what you've done is if you roll that out across the state, you're talking about disbursement of funds across perhaps 87 different counties or a number of different municipalities, and the process of spreading that trunk highway funding across all those areas would be difficult at best, in my opinion, sir. And keep in mind that 80 years ago, the Minnesota State Patrol was kind of formed under that premise that the state traffic laws would be enforced uniformly across the state of Minnesota, and so that as you travel across the state, you know that if you're stopped by a state trooper, whether it's in the southern part of the state, in the metropolitan area, or northern Minnesota, we treat everybody equally across the board, versus having that disbursement of law enforcement philosophy, let's say, about how traffic laws should be enforced. The second point, sir, that you brought up was the Capitol complex. And I know that that's a conversation that we're having right now. The governor has convened a group of people to talk about it. Keep in mind that the troopers and that the security that are at the Capitol complex are a general revenue fund. And so even if I wanted to, even if this committee told me tomorrow we want you to bring in 10 troopers to perform down here, statutorily we can't, because I would be using trunk highway funds to do that, then I can't do that. So we are going to have a conversation about the security of this complex, what the governor and what the bodies would like to see there, and then how we go about doing that. So I hope that answers your question, sir.
That's fine. Thanks.
Thank you, Colonel. Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Madam Commissioner, just a quick question on the previous slide concerning the $19 million in federal funds. Is there a chance you could get a little more specific about that, where those funds come from and what they're allocated to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Krause, primarily they come through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and they are for DWI enforcement and high-speed enforcement activities.
Okay, thank you.
Salison.
Let me just run quickly through the State Patrol services. They include aviation, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, a drug recognition expert, vehicle crimes unit, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigative services, public information, training. We have a training academy, radio communications, special response teams, and federal programs. With that, I'm going to see if you have any other questions for Colonel Danaski.
I do, Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious. I'm planning on attending that academy. Are you going to let us in on what you're going to do to us when we get there for those 4 hours, Chief?
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I told you, then the surprise would be gone and you might not show up.
I figured you were going to say that, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Krause, I just would say that I went through the academy, and it's an absolutely wonderful experience. I'm not a police officer, and it was really great. And I think it gives people, you with your background probably already know all of this, but it really gives people an understanding of what kind of situations we're putting these troopers in. And we, you know, did some traffic stops and some different things, and it gave me a really, really good perspective of the kind of situations they face. So I would encourage people to attend.
And the feedback that we are receiving from that program has been terrific, too, and appreciate you offering the opportunity for us and staff to attend that.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, if there was an opportunity to taser Senator Perry, I'll do that.
Mr. Chair, I need to say
respond,
nothing.
Colonel. Oh. Ms. Ellison.
All right, well, then we'll move on to the Office of Traffic Safety. Their vision is to reduce fatalities and serious injuries to zero on Minnesota's roadways. Their mission is to lead efforts to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries by changing behavior on the roadways in Minnesota. The Office of Traffic Safety includes a traffic safety outreach program, the impaired driving prevention program, promotion of seatbelt use, child passenger safety, traffic records and data systems, safe road coalitions, motorcycle safety, teen drivers, underage alcohol prevention, distracted driving prevention, traffic safety research and analysis, crash outcome and data evaluation, and fatality analysis record system. The Office of Traffic Safety receives an annual appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund of $435,000, which is a match that we use to secure more than $37 million annually. The Towards Zero Death is a partnership between the Minnesota Departments of Public Safety, Transportation, and Health, and many traffic safety advocates and organizations. The mission of Towards Zero Deaths is to create a culture in which traffic fatalities and serious injuries are no longer acceptable through the application of education, engineering, enforcement, and emergency medical and trauma services. With that, I'll ask Cherie Marty, who is the Director of Office of Traffic Safety, to come forward, and she's going to point out a few things and then answer any questions that you would have.
Ms. Marty, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Cherie Marty. I am the Director of Traffic Safety with the Office of Traffic Safety. And the spelling of my name is Cherie, C-H-E-R-I, Marty, M-A-R-T-I. Essentially, Minnesota is making tremendous gains in traffic safety. Since 2003, overall, we've seen a steady decline in traffic fatalities and serious injuries on our roadways. And I will tell you that our partnership with the Minnesota State Patrol, together with local law enforcement, is absolutely essential for us to see the type of gains that we've experienced in Minnesota. Just to let you know, on a national level, Minnesota is ranked number 2 in our fatality rate, and that's calculated by looking at vehicle miles traveled against the fatalities. And there's only one state ahead of Minnesota doing better in their fatality rate, so we are making tremendous strides. Right now, in 2010, looking at our fatalities, today we stand at 411 fatalities in 2010. And that is a good number. Of course, it's never something to celebrate when you've got over 400 people dying on our roadways. But if you look at just earlier in this decade, Minnesota was averaging over 600 fatalities a year. We have brought that number continuously down. And it's law enforcement out there reinforcing and reminding folks of how to keep themselves safe that makes a tremendous difference on our roadways. And we couple that enforcement with a lot of media and letting the public know that law enforcement is enforcing these laws. So we make sure that the public is informed, that we have strong awareness campaigns with that enforcement. In addition, as Mary mentioned earlier, our partnership with the Towards Zero Death Program, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Health, these are key stakeholders and partners in our efforts statewide. In addition, I just want to mention that we are seeing a tremendous decline in our motorcycle fatalities. Just last year alone, we have dropped over 7%, so we are looking at 41 rider deaths as compared to 53 rider deaths in 2009. So we're making tremendous gains. Also, with our serious injuries, these are life-changing injuries. Those have dropped to about 1,100 a year. And that, just a couple years ago, was like 1,300 a year. So again, tremendous gains are truly being made. So with that, I think we're truly moving in the right direction, and we know that a cornerstone to this has been the strong traffic safety legislation that the legislature has supported. So that, coupled with all the activities that Mary has outlined, we believe is truly making a strong difference.
No questions? Ms. Allison?
Chair.
Senator Sengel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Marty. Can you give us, I'm just maybe asking for your impression, data is what I'd really like, and I voted for the mandatory seat belts, but is there any data that could be shown to anyone that would suggest that has saved lives? We think it does, but if you look at it over time, is there evidence to suggest that?
Mr. Chair and members, there's no question that when we look at when we passed primary seatbelt when it went into effect June 9th of 2009, and we looked at just 5 months of data, and we compared that 5 months with the same time frame from the previous year, we had saved more than 23 lives. And these are individuals that clearly, so we have been looking at the data, and we're taking that same time frame. So it is clearly making a difference, and the fact that our trend line is continuing to go down, we know that our belt use is at an all-time high of 92%. Last year it was at 90%. The year before that it was at 87%. More Minnesotans are buckling up more than ever. We're also seeing a tremendous decline in our serious injury data. And we know that it's because people are buckling up, that they're, what would have been a fatality might now be a serious injury. What would have been a serious life-changing injury is now a moderate to minor injury. So we're seeing that ripple effect of what would have been fatal or very serious is now more moderate to minor injury. So if that is helpful.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator, for bringing that up. I was actually wondering the same question, and I'm appreciative of you giving those statistics because that's really what I was wondering. I knew we were already at a high participation rate had we gotten higher, which you indicate you had. So I would just share anecdotally, the same day that the primary seatbelt law went into effect, there were two headlines in the News Tribune, the Duluth News Tribune that day. One was the law going into effect. The other was a 19-year-old who was killed in northern St. Louis County, ejected from his vehicle, not wearing a seatbelt. So we know, as the senator said, we know anecdotally, so thank you for sharing the facts about it as well.
Thank you.
Senator Gazalka.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Marty, kind of along those same lines, I'm just wondering how in the world you measure it, because, you know, how did you know they weren't going to have a seatbelt on in the first place? I don't think anybody asks that question. Other than the overall data, I don't know how else you can possibly measure that. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm not disagreeing with you, other than I hate to make assumptions. I know we have safer cars, and, you know, so...
Mr. Chair and members, it is difficult. There are many variables that go into why someone is fatally wounded or seriously injured in a crash. What we do know is that let's look at the evening hours. We do know that 63% of our unbelted fatalities are occurring at night, much more in the evening. We're seeing far more fatalities in the evening that are unbelted, with the exception of as compared to during the day. We don't know, but a lot of research has been done through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the National Insurance Institute, and all of the data points to the fact that seatbelts make a big difference. If you're in a rollover crash, that seatbelt can prevent a fatal injury by 80%. We know that you're four times more likely to be injured in a crash if you're not wearing a seatbelt. So, yes, it is hard to isolate all of the variables that could make a difference. But if you're out on the road and you're sharing that road with drivers that are aggressive, distracted, impaired, your best defense is your seatbelt. We know that, and we're seeing it in our numbers. You know, the belt law is there to save lives, to prevent serious injuries. We're seeing strong results with that. So, yes, we do point to strong legislation like primary seatbelt that we know is making a difference.
Thank you. I'd also like to let members know that there is other information about each of these divisions in your packet for your review, and that information might also inspire some questions and additional conversations along these department lines. So appreciate that. Ms. Allison.
Moving on then to the Division of Drivers.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sanjo.
One more just fleeting question. It's kind of along the same lines, but this time not seat belts, but DWI stings, if you will. Do we know that DWI stings? Do we have any reason to think, based on data, that they help? Or is it just spending a lot of money?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and members, the Office of Traffic Safety supports enhanced enforcement. That enhanced enforcement is looking at seatbelt usage, speed, and impaired driving. And we do support activities of state and local police to enhance that enforcement, to help keep our roads safe. That enforcement is always widely publicized. It's not something that is secretive. We are supporting officers in uniform, working their shifts on the enforcement waves that we have broadly advertised to the public through a variety of forms of media. We do press conferences, news releases. We're advertising our enforcement widely and telling the public this is the enforcement that you can expect. During the enforcement, we're also telling the public this is what's happening, and then we wrap up with this is what we've done. So there's nothing that's secretive, and these are all supported by federal dollars and not state dollars as well.
Thank you, Mayor. Just to a follow-up, relative to that, Ms. Marty, and I've never been a victim of one of these, but just procedurally, mm-hmm. we do see the light board saying all of the what you described. Procedurally, might an officer just randomly pull any car off to the side? Does there have to be, if you will, due cause or some reason? Might I, for instance, just get pulled over and asked to blow into a breathalyzer, or does there need to be some level of reason?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senza, my understanding is you have to have probable cause to pull somebody over, but I'm going to ask Colonel Danaski if he wants to add to that answer.
Mr. Chair, Mark Danaski. Senator, relative to a DWI stop is no different than any of our traffic stops. We have to have probable cause to pull a vehicle over. And in reference to a DWI, the officer will talk to the individual, and they really need to be able to articulate why they have a suspicion that the individual is driving while intoxicated before they go further.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Colonel.
Mr. Chair,
Allison.
And Senator Sanjum, I'm just reminded, too, that Minnesota does not do random checkpoints, if that's maybe what
right?
you were.
Okay.
We don't do those.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the clarification. Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a statement for Senator Sanjum, whether you call it enhanced, I remember back 33 years ago when I participated heavily, so I don't know if anybody here remembers, back when we thought we had a bad speeding problem, and they instituted Operation 55. Mm-hmm. And today, Senator, you'll know the area when I go back to Hayward, Minnesota, on County Road 26, and back then Highway 16 back in those days, mm-hmm. there are people that still remember that enhanced enforcement. We just called it a different name. So I believe when it's done right, any kind of the enhanced enforcement when it comes to traffic safety does set the mindset, and I think even today when you see those signs flashing enhanced, it does make a difference.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Ellison or Ms. Marty, if you could speak a little bit to general traffic trends at this point. I think that's an important piece that I don't believe we've heard yet. What is the traffic usage as we look at these levels going up and down? Can you give us some information on that?
Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and members, the general traffic trends, if you're talking about vehicle miles traveled, that has been a steady incline, so we're seeing more travel. In the last 3-4 years, that has leveled off quite a bit. It's not dropped as some have anticipated because of the poor economy. What we're seeing is less long-term travel on interstate rural roads and more travel on local urban roads, mainly because people are not doing the leisure long-range travel as they once did, probably because of the economy. But the total vehicle miles traveled is about the same. So with that said, in terms of traffic safety trends, as I've already mentioned, we're seeing great gains in the overall fatalities. Motorcycle fatalities have also dropped. The pedestrian fatalities we are seeing about the same as last year. So that we're not quite making the gains, but it's certainly better than we were 4 years ago. The bicycle fatalities, that again is also dropped just a bit. Is there any other area that you're looking at? Do you want numbers with respect to
no,
those?
Mr. Chairman, no, thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good.
Senator Hall?
And Mr. Chair, excuse me. I was wondering if you could speak to, you know, I do think that the prevention and the advertisements and the ads that are on TV are a good thing. I'm trying to recall Senator Sinjim's question raised. It almost, to me, gives a perception on some of those commercials, or at least one of them, that there is like a road stop or a roadblock. I can't remember, but I don't know if that's a good perception or not. But I was just wondering if you could speak to the effectiveness of those ads. And I really do think that prevention is a lot better than trying to enforce it on the penalty side. But if you could speak to that.
Mr. Marty?
Mr. Chair and members, the whole point behind enhanced enforcement is to create a fear of apprehension, because we've learned from the studies that it's that fear of apprehension that changes driver behavior. So we through the public outreach and public awareness, that we are letting the public know that if you are going to drink and drive, you will be caught and you will be apprehended. You will be stopped. So it's about creating the mindset of the public that if you're out on the roads and you're engaging in dangerous driving behavior, that there will be consequences. Because many drivers think they have an attitude that they can do what they would like behind the wheel, and they're not assessing the risk that they're posing to other drivers. So it is that fear of apprehension that study after study after study has shown that truly is what changes driver behavior. A case in point, a child can be buckled up their entire childhood, and parents have carefully ensured that that child has been restrained. They get their license, they're in the car with their friends, and too often, these young drivers that are inexperienced, they unbuckle themselves. They know better. They know that they shouldn't, but they do it anyway. But as soon as they get a seatbelt citation and they have to pay that fine, their behavior changes. So we also know that you don't drink and drive, but far too many people, still 30% of our fatalities are alcohol-related. People know not to get behind the wheel impaired, and yet far too many are doing it anyway. The only way to stop them is to create the awareness that if they do it, they will get caught. And so if we have an enforcement concentration on a roadway, I know myself, I was driving north on Highway 100, it was around the July 4th holiday, and I saw four squads, and it was squads working together, and it was in a condensed area, and it really left an impact on me, because I thought, wow, they are out here in force. People better watch what they're doing. And that's, we want to create that sense of, we're out here, we're watching what you're doing, and if you engage in dangerous driving behavior, you will get caught, and there will be consequences. And all of that is to create a change in their driving behavior. Does that answer your question?
Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Marty, could you talk a little bit about the booster seat compliance since we passed that bill, what was it, 2007?
Mr. Chair and members, we had passed the booster seat bill in 2009, and what we are seeing is a dramatic increase in the amount of uninjured children in crashes. So although the total number of children that are killed in car crashes is relatively small, so if you look at kids age 8 and under, typically we'll have 6 to 8 children die each year. Mm-hmm. But the serious injuries, and that's also one of our goals, is to lessen that. So here you have children that are not being injured. So we're seeing approximately an 18% increase in uninjured children in car crashes.
Ms. Marty, I'm sorry. Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up. And if I recall, the federal government gave the state, once we passed that bill, money for free booster seats.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that the department still is getting grant money for? And I had a constituent who was looking for one, so how would I go about trying to locate a booster seat for a constituent who needs one?
Sure.
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and members, that money is being used to pay for booster seats for needy families. It's about $60,000 a year that we receive in federal funds, and that's money that will, the money that I just mentioned, the $60,000, that's actually the state-level fund. It's a dedicated fund for those that have been stopped for not having their child properly restrained. There's a $50 fee, and that fee goes into this fund. So we use that fund. But in addition to that, we do have the federal money, and that is going towards buying car seats as well as training for instructors that are doing child passenger safety instruction and courses and clinics around the state. So in order to connect with that, I could certainly have Heather Darby, who is our child passenger safety coordinator, and she is responsible for purchasing those seats and also distributing them.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay, thank you. Can you talk a little bit about the compliance with that 2009 child restraint law? And you just threw out a couple of numbers here, $60,000 off of a $50 fee for the violation. That seems like it would be a lot of violations. Did I not hear that right?
No, Mr. Chair, you did hear that correctly, and I understand that that's the way that fund is created. I'm just going to check with.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
And as far as compliance goes,
there was a survey that was conducted in 2008 prior to the passage of the booster seat bill. And what they did is they actually surveyed those cars that were coming into seatbelt clinics to see if their seats were actually installed correctly. And only 37% of those that were viewed, those car seats, they were installed correctly, only 37%. So the vast majority were installed incorrectly. Now, the good news is that we did a survey last year, and through that survey, 97% of those adults that completed that survey are aware of the booster seat law. So we've made strides there. And so we do know that our clinics and the instructor training for those technicians to teach the public how to install these correctly is very important, and our funding is going to support that. We are embarking this year for the first time is an actual observation survey for child seats. That's something that we're designing right now. We have not yet implemented, but that is part of the plan for this year.
We'd certainly like to know the results of that survey.
Sure.
as we move forward. Thank
and that'll
that.
Be a baseline. You know, we haven't done that survey in the past, but at least we can start with this year with the new law in effect as to what the compliance rate is, and that'll be something that will continue in the future.
Thank you. Ms. Ellison?
Moving on then to driver and vehicle services. Their mission is committed to providing fast, fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and business partners. Driver and Vehicle Services has an annual operating budget of approximately $55 million with 538 employees working in 98 locations throughout the state. $950 million in state revenue is generated annually through fees collected by the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. The division is funded by the Special Revenue Fund and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. DVS services include title and registration, driver exam, driver compliance, driver's license issuance, special plates and disability parking credentials, auto dealer licensing and salvage vehicle inspection, interstate truck licensing and fuel tax, public information center, and document management and records. I'm going to ask Ms. McCormick, who is Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, to come forward in case people have questions.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. McCormick. Good to have you back, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat McCormick, McCormack, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. if
Reiner, I guess, has a question right off the bat. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. If Ms. McCormick, if you've got comments, go ahead, and I'll reserve my question.
Thank you.
No, that's fine. Mr. Chair, that's fine. Senator.
You can go anytime you'd like, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome. We've spent a lot of time together. As long as you're here, I thought maybe you could give us just an update on the enhanced driver's license process. For members who might not be completely familiar with that, we got this passed last year, and it allows for more secure and more efficient travel, especially with our northern neighbors in Canada, but applies elsewhere. And I see over in the corner Mr. Estenson, who was wearing a different hat at that time with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, who did a lot of work on this as well. But nice to see you again, Pat.
Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Reinert. The Enhanced Driver's License initiative passed last legislative session, and that process requires the department to work with the Federal Department of Homeland Security to come up with an agreement in terms of the security features and the process for Minnesota to issue an enhanced driver's license or an enhanced ID card. And that enhanced driver's license or ID card can be used for travel by land or sea, not by air. And so it was the goal of the initiative is for us to work through those issues because of the fact that DVS would have to have additional $75,000 change item to our current contract. The effective date of that legislation is at the end of fiscal year 2013, so that by July 1st, 2014, the department would need to be able to offer those that license or ID card to citizens in Minnesota. The department and I specifically have had a few discussions with the Department of Homeland Security in terms of understanding what they're looking for from us. And at this point in time, they've sent us some examples from some of the other states that are now issuing them. And we will be moving forward in terms of, first of all, we have to come to an agreement with the department and outline how we would see the process working. They need to understand the rules and regulations that we have in place right now for issuing driver's licenses and ID cards. And so we will be sharing that with them. And then at that time, once we come to some agreement, then the next step would be to look at issuing an enhanced driver's license and ID card, and then we'd be working on security features, which would be very similar to the security features that are on our current driver's license.
Senator Reiner?
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And as I recall, completely voluntary. I think that's an important point we always need to make in this conversation. But as I also recall, one of the reasons we pushed it into the future was to take advantage of the annual, I think it was 5-year rebidding of the driver's license software. And at the end, I think we brought that fiscal note down to a negligible amount, if I'm remembering that right.
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that is correct. Mm-hmm. That was the other reason for pushing it out, because we thought that that would provide the state with enough time that it could be incorporated into the next driver's license contract that we would be pursuing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, before I ask my question, I do want to, when Ms. McCormick is at the table, I always take the opportunity to thank her publicly for all the constituent service help I get from her and her office, and recommend to every member of the committee probably the most frequent constituent service request you're going to have is some glitch with driver's license or license plates or title transfers or that sort of thing, because, you know, there's so many different unique situations and circumstances out there, and I encourage you to call Ms. McCormick. She'll get it cleared up lickety-split. Every single problem I've encountered has been handled very efficiently, and my constituents are always extremely happy. So thank you.
Thank you.
So on this subject and this enhanced driver's license thing that we passed last year, kind of gets mixed into the whole Real ID discussion. Two questions. One is, you know, I assume this does not put us at variance with kind of legislative direction to kind of civil disobedience, I guess, that we passed unanimously in both the House and the Senate. I think there was one vote of the 201 in opposition, you know, seeking that we not comply with that directive from on high. Assume that this is not in conflict with that, but how close does that get us to compliance with the requirements of Real ID?
Ms. McCormick?
Senator, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble, I would say that the issue with the department not and the state not being allowed to implement Real ID has very little to do with the security requirements and the rules and regulations that we administer. In almost every case, our rules and our process and the security features that we have on our driver's license meet any security standards that are talked about when they talk about the Real ID requirements or in the Real ID requirements that are being passed. The issue that was a concern, I think, at the time that this legislation passed, that the Minnesota not issue Real ID approved cards had more to do with the data practices issues that the legislators were expressed concerns with, and that would be the fact that you're verifying information with federal systems, and that is not part of our process in the respect that the concerns were raised. But in terms of the fact that we require you to have legal presence or that you must be a citizen within the United States to get a driver's license, we do require those, that we do require two forms of identity in order to issue an ID card or a driver's license. And we allow for people that have legal presence to be able to, that are here temporarily, to be able to get a driver's license or an ID card that has that status check date, which is the date that their legal presence would end, would be on the driver's license. And so those, we have various features that would comply with Real ID if that was enacted, but it is not enacted, and so we are not pursuing the Real ID card, but we still want to have the most secure driver's license that we can, and we still want to ensure that people are who they say they are, and so that's how our process has been set up.
Senator DeCree.
Thank you, Chairman Gimsey. I have a question on the I know you did mention that our IDs in Minnesota are among as secure as any IDs in the country, and you're to the highest standards. I'm not suggesting Minnesota IDs are being falsified, but some are, as we know that we have different groups of people that might want to have a false ID, sometimes to get into drink underage, sometimes to work under a false identification. Are there some states that are a lot more prevalent in those areas that you might talk about? And are Minnesota IDs immune from that type of activity?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator and members, I don't think there's any state that's immune from having some incidents of fraud with issuing driver's licenses or ID cards. I do think that, in general, that most states have tried very hard to meet the requirements that are established, whether we're implementing Real ID or not, that did force those discussions among motor vehicle agencies and agencies that issue driver's licenses and ID cards. But from my experience and from most experience of other motor vehicle administrators, the key is to ensure that we are always improving and that we add additional enhanced technology as it's made available in terms of security features on cards and those kinds of things, because those are very important in terms of ensuring that we have a card that wouldn't be easily replicated. And so those are things that we definitely work on and try to improve on with every contract that we have in terms of issuing driver's licenses and ID cards.
Ms. McCormick, I think probably part of the question isn't so much of being able to duplicate the Minnesota driver's licenses, but can you talk a little bit about the background documentations that allow a person to get a Minnesota driver's license? Because really that's the area where I hear a significant amount of the fraud is that false and faked birth certificates and other documents, stolen identification, social security numbers and names are being used to get a Minnesota driver's license and ID card. Can you tell us what the department is doing to try to reduce the prevalence of that?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and members, there are several different programs that we've been working on and we've been working on and trying to improve all the time. Certainly, one is that all of our staff are trained every year, as well as our driver license agent staff, on recognition of fraudulent documents. And that technology, in terms of recognition and in terms of having it readily available so that we have we are able to know what other states' driver's licenses look like and the security features on other driver's licenses, that is information that now we provide to every single office, not only our own staff offices, but our driver license agent offices. We have a process where if we are suspecting that there may be fraud, that there's additional investigation that's done in those particular cases. We are not an over-the-counter issuance process. We require the second look, so we take an application in, but those applications then come into our central office, and if there's any suspected fraud, that fraud is investigated in our office. If we suspect fraud, we can, what we do is call, we say that application is put into suspense, and at that time we send a letter to that individual, and we tell them that if we know that they've applied for a license, there are some concerns with the license, and that in order to have us issue the license, they will need to meet with a driver evaluator and provide additional documentation so that we're sure that they are who they say they are. If they don't come into the office within the days that are requested in the letter, then that license application is canceled. And so we do work in various ways to ensure that. Certainly, we always need to keep improving. And we also have worked on a fraudulent recognition program where we're doing scrubs of our photos and our photo database in order to ensure that if there is the likelihood that someone is not who they say they are, that then we can require an additional interview and that we could cancel that license if it's deemed to be fraudulent.
Senator DeCree.
Thank you, Chairman Gimsey. I have another question about IDs, and this may be one that might be directed to the Highway Patrol as much as anything. But my question is, in the squad cars, if an officer runs across a person who gives them an identification, do you have in your squad cars a way of determining if that is a legal identification or if it's an illegal identification? And if it's found to be not a legal identification, do you at all times confiscate that illegal identification?
Don't go very far, Mrs. McCorn. Ms. McCorn. Colonel Donansky.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I understand your question right, in our squad cars, we have mobile data computers that we run the not only the driver's license but the registration of the motor vehicle as well. It covers all the states in the United States, and it typically will come back. Really what we're waiting for is for them to come back and tell us whether it's valid or not. Troopers and most law enforcement officers are also trained to look at identification cards and look for obvious signs of fraudulent cards. I don't know that there's really anything that comes across our computer that would identify. We don't have a process where you can put the card in and determine whether or not it's fraudulent or not. We really rely on the databases that are out there and the training of the troopers to look at the cards.
Okay.
Senator DeCree, follow-up?
The second part of my question was, if you find something that you are questioning as being a legal identification, an illegal identification, do you confiscate that or no?
Colonel Donansky.
Mr. Chair, if we determine that, if we can determine that a driver's license, let's say, for instance, a driver's license that somebody has for reasons of purchasing alcohol has created a card, and the trooper is confident that the card was modified and can literally articulate that, look, the card has been modified, the picture is different or something that's on your, they could confiscate the card. In most cases, if you can't make that positive determination, they won't, but they certainly would do follow-up on it to find out what the issue is behind it.
Senator DeCree.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Gimsey. One last question and something of a comment. I believe that there was a fatal bus crash a couple of years ago where an illegal driver's license or a false ID of some sort and had been driving and was known to be false. And what I'm hoping is that there wasn't a traffic stop prior to that where this person was found to have an illegal identification, was allowed to keep it, and continued her practice of driving, which ended up in a fatality. I'm hoping that we're doing things to make sure that doesn't happen.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to speak specifically to that situation because I don't know the specifics of the how the license was fraudulent or where it came from. Some of the challenges, and I certainly let the Commissioner, Ms. McCormick, speak to it, is that some of the licenses that are being obtained fraudulently are being obtained by people that are very, very good at what they do, coming up with, I'm not speaking for Ms. McCormick, but just some of the knowledge that we have, people obtaining birth certificates that are, for all intents and purposes, legal birth certificates that come and get a driver's license in our state that, by virtue of going down three steps, is a fraudulent license because the birth certificate was wrong. It's very difficult for a trooper in the field to be able to determine that. For all intents and purposes, they have a valid Minnesota driver's license. But I will say again, from Ms. McCormick's standpoint, we are cognizant of the issue of fraudulent driver's licenses. The troopers are aware of it. They're constantly looking for that. And when we do find something, I would say that you can rest assured that if a trooper suspects that there's something there, that they're going to take some type of follow-up action on it and at least try to verify that it's valid.
Thank you.
See, I have Senator Howe and then Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, my question is for Ms. McCormick. I've got two questions, or a question and a follow-up. How long does it take to get a renewal license? What's the process when you do a renewal? How long does it take to get a renewal driver's license if you've already had one?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator and members, the turnaround time for driver's licenses currently is 23 days. the renewal license process can be sooner than that, but that's the average turnaround for all of our driver's licenses. So that's new, duplicate, and renewal. A lot of times, if there's nothing new in the driver's license, it's a 3-day turnaround process.
Okay.
Senator Lilly?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair. And I guess my question is, with today's technology and because of the travel requirements with TSA and all those things, if somebody has a flight and doesn't have a driver's license but had one, can't find their driver's license, goes in, you know, especially if they're traveling somewhere, where, any airport, they're going to have a photo valid ID. And I'm just wondering, with today's technology on a renewal, when, you know, you can look in the computer, you can look at the person and, you know, physically photo ID them, why we don't have a process where we have some sort of a same-day process located somewhere in our state. Then I think the nearest is you'd have to go to Chicago to get a same-day passport, or to Seattle to get a same-day passport. I guess Chicago, you could probably get it in the same day if you planned. But for those requirements to make it for our state of Minnesota, I'm just wondering how we can work on, you know, I'm certain people would pay whatever the fee is, if it's a, you know, a $50 surcharge or a $100 surcharge to get a same-day ID. With today's technology on a renewal, that we can't provide a quicker turnaround in 3 days.
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we do have a fast-track process for driver's licenses and for motor vehicle transactions, where if it comes directly to the department, it's a $10 fee, and if it goes through a deputy registrar, it's a $20 fee. And that it isn't a same-day process. The main reason is that the vendor that we use produces the cards out of state, and so we can get them within 3 days, but where you'd have it delivered at your home within 3 days, but it wouldn't be the same day. But I also want to state that we have had several constituents that have lost their driver's license. They're out of state. And if that happens, we have an arrangement that we have run through the Transportation Security Administration so that we will provide a certified letter with our driver license, the driver license photo of that individual, to the and it's written specifically to TSA, stating that this person is the driver, and they have to certainly verify certain things before we do that, but we will do that and then provide that driver with that letter, or we'll send it to whomever we need to send it to so that they can get through if they need to. And we don't do that, certainly, we do it a couple times a month, I'd say. So there is a way that we handle those things right now.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad to hear that we have that. Is that a program that the deputy registers or people, you know, out know that process is available to them?
Mr. Chair and Senator, we have to deal directly with the constituent, but yes, we've made that known to our driver license agents, but it can only come through our office because we're the only ones that would be authorized to issue any kind of information like that, just for security purposes.
Mr. Chair, no, that's just great that as long as they know that that's available and they have to contact you directly, but I see that as an opportunity. Can you tell us where out of state our driver's license are created?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Senator and members, they're created in the state of Washington.
Thank you.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and thank you, Ms. McCormick. I happened to pull out my personal driver's license, and I'm a little challenged by the photo that's on it. Wondering what we can do with the quality of that. My wife gives me a hard time about the weight on it also. I don't know if that's something that we can work on. But I did actually have a question, and that is
it's probably only as good as the information you put into that.
That might be the problem, yes. My question is the scope of of how many driver's licenses are there in the state of Minnesota? What percent of driving age adults have them? What percent do not have driver's licenses? And, you know, the different categories of driver's licenses, how many are we talking about? What is the scope of what your department is doing?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator and members, we have approximately 3.7 million drivers in the state of Minnesota. I don't remember the number of ID card holders that we have, but we also have, and in that 3.7 million, that would be all drivers that we're talking about. So that would include commercial drivers as well as, when there's four classes of commercial drivers, as well as Class D drivers, and as well as provisional drivers. I certainly can get those statistics for you and send them to the chair and all the members of the committee if you'd like.
Yes,
I would like that information.
Mr. Chair, with particular interest in what percent of Minnesotans have an ID or license of some kind? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator DeLillo. Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the only way that we'd probably be able to do that would be to just take look at the state's population. We'd have to work probably with the demographer to look at how many adults there are in the state and then look at how that relates to who we have in terms of drive. That'd be the only way, so it won't be any scientific process, but we'll work, see if the demographer's office could assist us with it.
Very good. Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This Commissioner, I'm looking at that special plates and disability parking credentials. I'm thinking special plates. I think already I have seen four requests for special plates, and I'm wondering, does the department have, and I can't remember from last year, but does the department have a position on all of the different, it seems like I've already heard that there could be a possibility of a trunk highway 14 and a female veterans and all these different plates. Do you have a position on that, good, bad, or where are we going with this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, let me just say that when I was a little girl, we had five children in my family, and we'd go to the ice cream store, and my dad would say, okay, what does everybody want? And we'd say, you know, chocolate, strawberry, whatever. And he'd come back always with all vanilla. And so from our standpoint, from an administrative perspective, we'd like to have all vanilla. But we understand that, you know, it's the legislator's prerogative to get bills passed, and it's our responsibility to enact as best as we can within the resources we have the legislation that's passed. I guess that's about as best as I can answer. Okay.
Can you tell us how many special plates there are currently out there? What is the usage? How many do we have that we probably only issue four or five? I imagine this discussion will probably come up again during the budget discussions when we talk about what these cost, when we look at the fiscal impacts. But there are quite a number. I think, if I remember last year, 140-some specialty plates and being used at different levels. But, we'll get down to the nitty-gritty of it later in the budget talk. So thanks for the question, Senator Perry.
I'd
like to continue on. Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, we have 70 types of special plates, and I don't have the actual numbers, but we do have a chart that provides on a yearly basis the numbers of different Minnesotans and the numbers of the types of plates that they have. So we do have a chart like that we could provide to the committee if you're interested in that.
We'll look for that in the future then, Ms. McCormick. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, you'd like
Chair,
to. Senator Senjum.
And not a question, but maybe just to follow up on Senator Dearbel's comment. Ms. McCormick is you will, the queen of thorny problems. And and I would just suggest to any member that if you need help with a problem, she's always there, and her attitude is one to find a solution rather than to say no. So thank you so much for what you do.
Thank you very much, Senator.
I think those sentiments reflect the sentiments of the entire committee and the state of Minnesota. You do process a lot of information and do a lot of hard work, along with your deputy registrars, who are really the front door to all of what we do with our vehicles and our driver's licenses. I know one thing for sure, you don't want to make the deputy registrars angry in your communities because they talk to everybody. So, but thank you very much, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you.
Finally, then, we have the Office of Pipeline Safety, and their mission is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. The budget for the Office of Pipeline Safety is $3.15 million per year in special revenue and federal funds. $1.35 million per year is a direct appropriation from the special revenue and that is derived from inspection fees. The Office of Pipeline Safety does pipeline inspections, major pipeline project inspections, pipeline incident investigations, enforcement, and damage prevention. The Office of Pipeline Safety is within the Office of State Fire Marshal, and Jerry Rosendahl is here to answer any questions you would have about their operation.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Rosendahl, if you'd state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal, and also Director of Pipeline Safety. Just a few statistics for you that's in the, I believe, the one-page handout you have on each division. The Office of Pipeline Safety, many of you will recall the Moundsview explosion of 1986, where two fatalities occurred due to the pipeline leak and resulting fire and explosion. So in 1987, the state legislature created the Office of Pipeline Safety. Our inspectors deal with over 73,000 miles of pipeline, and that's everything from the very small line that goes into your gas meter all the way up to 48-inch pipelines that provide the transportation route for gas and also hazardous liquid all the way from Alaska or Canada to the other parts in the country. In 2010, our office conducted 1,259 inspections, and that is, over that 70,000-plus miles of pipeline in Minnesota. We investigated 148 pipeline-related events in 2010. We did have a couple, three, that were quite significant with house explosions, et cetera. As a result of all those investigations, we wrote 68 enforcement actions that addressed 344 probable incident or pipeline-related violations. Another part of our program is what we call damage prevention, which is certainly the public education piece, which we do as well as during pipeline inspections and also with excavators and civilians related to the Gopher State One Call law, where before you dig, call within at least 48 hours prior to digging, and you get all those pretty colors painted all over your lawn. In 2010, our staff gave 74 damage prevention presentations to over 5,000 people, who were excavators, underground facility operators, and also the general public. On that particular law, the Gopher State One Call law, we issued 138 violations there, totaling over $56,000 in proposed penalties. But less than half of those violations did not result in a penalty, a fee. Our focus is on education. We use the penalty only as kind of a last resort. Our statistics that we collect demonstrate that the enforcement and education program has contributed to reducing damages to gas and electric facilities by nearly 70% since 1996. So the damage prevention effort is a steady decline. The number of incidents is on a decline. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Could you talk a little bit about the Gopher State One Call system and how that came about and the the results of that effort. I was working in the pipeline industry, natural gas industry at that time when it first came on, and remember the resistance on the part of contractors and others to get to embrace it completely, and just wondering how that's all coming about. Can you talk a little bit about the fees that are charged to the companies for the exchange of information and the locating services that are involved in that? Just real briefly, a quick overview.
Mr. Chair and members, the Gopher State One Call system or call center was created very shortly after the Office of Pipeline Safety was, in order to deal with this issue of digging in an area where there are pipelines and causing issues. Many people think that the Office of Pipeline Safety is the one that goes out and marks the lawns or wherever. The rest of the people think that the Gopher State One Call, when they call that number, they're talking to somebody who's going to end up going out and doing the marking. In fact, the reality is the utility operators, anybody who owns any telephone, cable, pipeline, gas, water, sewer, they are the owners, and they are the ones who either do it themselves or they contract with a professional locating company that goes out and actually does all the marking. The Gopher State One Call Center maintains a database of everything that's underground in Minnesota. If you're going to put in, you're going to dig a hole for your mailbox out at the end of your driveway, you call in the Gopher State One Call, give the address and what you're doing, exactly where you're at. They ask you to do a little white paint or something in that area, so you clearly designate where it is you're going to put the post, dig the hole. And you need to do that at least 48 hours prior to when you're going to actually do the digging. And then in that time period, all of the utilities that are possibly in on your property will come out and mark their facility with the different colors, and there's a specific color code for each of the facilities. And when it comes time, you do the digging and you put it in. The fee, I think, was part of your question. The companies that have underground facilities are the ones that actually pay for each of what we call the ticket. When you call in, there might be five or there might be seven utilities that are in that block. The one call comes in, there could be 2, 5, 7, or 10 calls or notices going out from the one call center to all of those utilities. And for each of those outgoing calls, if you will, a lot of this is being done now electronically, so we're saving on that end. Each of those outgoing calls then is assessed a particular fee. I don't recall just exactly what it is right now. And the utility companies pay that fee, and that's what is used to operate the center.
So it's pretty much self-sustaining as far as that goes. The amounts that they're charging for those outgoing calls has been increasing or increasing probably over time to cover the costs, because I know a lot of technology has also come into Gopher State One Call where they can use mapping now to pretty much pinpoint almost exactly where you're planning on doing your digging, your excavating.
Mr. Chair and members, you're exactly right. There's been a move over the last 8 years that I've been involved to more electronic, and it's just a lot more substantial than it used to be. But I lost my train of thought, sorry. The operational costs are completely paid for by that operating center. It's governed by a board of directors that's made up of all of the users, everything from landscapers, excavators, natural gas companies, pipeline companies, et cetera, and that board of directors then operates that and sets the fee. And actually, for the last couple of years, and I think projected for another couple of years, that fee is slated to remain the same, and partly because, as you said, the electronics and as everybody switching over to that is kind of holding down the expenses.
One final question for me. Where is that call center located, and how many employees are in there now?
Mr. Chair and members, the call center just actually moved and switched vendors. It used to be in Mendota Heights. It's now in Chanhassen. The number of employees in the center ramps up, of course, in February, March, April, as we get into that, and there could be 50 call center operators at any given time during the heavy time period, and could be down as few as half a dozen or so when you know, the off season, if you will.
Thank you, Senator Howe.
Chairman, as a senator that represents Goodhue and Wabasha County, I'm glad to see there were zero incidents or complaints on from there. But as Chairman Gimsey pointed out, we recently were over at 3M's Innovation Center, and they've got those RFI that they drop in. It can actually tell you what the pipeline is, what, you know, what's where exactly to pinpoint it exactly instead of using the magnetic. And I'm just wondering, you know, to bridge off of Senator Gimsey's comment, what technologies or what have we done in terms of promoting safety with a better, more accurate indicator of where these pipelines are at? It seems like technology has really made leaps and bounds, and I'm just wondering, have we, as the industry, or what do we have in ways, looking at your mission, in terms of legislation or statutes to make sure that we use the highest and best technology?
Mr. Rosendahl?
Mr. Chair and members, I think the technology advancements in detecting anomalies in pipelines as they send these products through has advanced, you know, astronomically in the 25 years that this has been going on. Our enforcement on a lot of the pipelines in Minnesota, which are interstate, comes under the authority of the Federal Office of Pipeline Safety. We follow their regulations. They are very, very strict and ever increasing on requirements. Our office doesn't have the equipment to actually monitor that. The responsibility remains with the utility company or the pipeline company to provide inspections and records, and then we come in as oversight and inspect those records and ask questions about that, and then enforce the both interstate and intrastate laws that govern those pipelines. So truly our ability to enforce safety, educate, push the safety envelope, the laws that are existing are very adequate, really, at this point. And we follow up on those incidents, issue penalties, and pursue that to the extent of the law.
And as I understand, you are the agent for the federal government, the Federal Pipeline Safety Organization, right?
Mr. Chair and members, correct. We are an interstate agent. We have a contract with the federal government, and that's how the federal funding comes to us, is under that agreement. We inspect the interstate lines in Minnesota, and they provide our funding for that up to actually a total cost of possibly 70% of our total budget. And that's all based on passing with a perfect score, actually three different audits per year that we're subjected to by the Federal Office of Pipeline Safety.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chairman, could you just explain what's the appeal process, or what's the process once a violation goes by, and how does that violation process work? Does that refer to the courts, or is it referred to something in your agency? And what's the resolution if somebody says, no, I didn't violate that?
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chair and members, on the Gopher State One Call law, where we're not dealing with huge, well, we have the ability to penalize and fine directly from our office the intrastate lines and then the Gopher State One Call law. On the interstate, since we're an agent for the federal government, we actually make recommendations to the feds, and they're the ones who initiate the actual penalties. In the case where intrastate and Gopher State One Call law, they would have an appeal, first of all, to me as the director of the pipeline safety. We take many of these cases to conciliation court, you know, depending on the dollar value of all that. Other than that, you know, they go through the administrative law hearing process.
Thank you.
No other questions? Ms. Ellingson, Mr. Rosendahl, thank you very much for your presentation. We'll look forward to
Before you let the commissioner go, I have one question
very
for
good.
You.
Senator Perry.
Thank you very much. Commissioner, and I know how Senator Gimsey wants to stay on time and be done right at 2:30, but I do have some questions about technology updates.
and how that's affected any of your workforce. Am I under the impression that you, the Department of Public Safety, went through a technology IT update here in the last couple of years, two, 3 years? Is that right or wrong?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, what you may be referring to is we are in the process of redoing our driver vehicle information system.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's what you're referring to.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Commissioner, is this, I guess, well, I'll let the cat out of the bag, okay? I was the recipient of a printed ticket through a computer. Okay, I've got a lot of cars, and I forgot to put tabs on one. But anyway, and it amazed me that it happened in a very small town, and that particular squad car had the technology to do that. And in my talking with the judicial branch and some of the judges, they related to me that they were somewhat interested that the state patrol hadn't brought their technology up so that all of the cars or I'm not sure how many of the cars, and maybe the chief can answer, have that kind of technology. Are we working that way? And I bring that up because I see the difference in the way that goes through the courts and the time savings of the people inputting, the manual inputting, if you follow my direction there. So maybe the chief can answer that.
Colonel Donansky.
Mr. Chair. Excellent question. As a matter of fact, just this past week, we started utilizing electronic citations in St. Louis County. The difference between the Minnesota State Patrol and a local jurisdiction moving over to electronic citations is the challenge that we have across the state of Minnesota. Each one of the county court systems has, in many ways, a different process for going through how the tickets come through. And so we've been working diligently, our staff, with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension through their system and through the court systems to try and get a process where we could label our tickets across the state so that there would be some continuity. As a matter of fact, one of the biggest challenges for us, and many of you may know, is that Hennepin County has their own ticket. They have a separate ticket from all the other 86 states or 86 counties that they issue in that county alone. So the challenge that we had was trying to come together and to try and do something that would work across the state of Minnesota. We're moving in that direction.